Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to begin our session here, Building Faith Communities in a Time of Crisis. And my only role is to introduce the speaker. Unfortunately, the chief of police, Cameron McLay, he is not able to be here. Reverend Glenn Garrett Grayson, Sr., is the pastor of Wesley Center AME Zion Church in the Hill District in the city of Pittsburgh. He is the founder and executive director of Center That Cares, an organization dedicating to supporting the community through an array of educational and developmental programming. A native of Brooklyn, New York, he is a graduate of Livingstone College and the Hood Theological Seminary. Reverend Grayson is an active member of the region through its service on various community boards and a tireless advocate for gun violence prevention, reform, and education. His efforts have been acknowledged by the White House when designated as a champion of change. He is married to attorney Marcia C. Hughes Grayson, the proud father of Glenn Grayson, Jr., Erica, Sonora Grayson Johnson, Harry, and the late Jerron Xavier Grayson, and the father of Anaya Grayson, the grandfather of Anaya Grayson and Xavier Grayson.
Testing. Good afternoon, everybody. This afternoon, I'm humbled by the invitation to share in the 16th annual Pittsburgh Pastoral Care Conference to stand before this group. I'm blessed in His will and pressed in His purpose to speak from the topic Building Faith Communities in a Time of Crisis. I understand the goal and takeaways. Pastors will learn how congregations can best respond to gun violence, fear, and the threat of terrorism in their community. I must say, for transparency, I confess that I don't do well with like topics and subjects and text sometime when I'm invited. I often say yes and don't know what I got myself into. Worse than that, I rarely ask for details, and oftentimes upon preparing, I'm not sure if I understood the exact assignment, but nevertheless, here am I. So please forgive me, and I'll understand if this is my first and last invitation. Once the crowd heard that the chief was not here, I understand why. It's just us, but I'm grateful that we're here. I promise that I won't keep you long. I'm kind of like what Elizabeth Taylor said to her seven husbands. I don't plan to keep you long. So, especially with being the only presenter, we will be in and out. But our topic is really what wrestled with me. Building faith communities in a time of crisis. And as I pondered and thought about that, I had to first ask myself the question, how do we as individuals or collectively today, as pastors or lay leaders or ministers or social workers, how do we define a crisis? How do we define it? Of course, if you Google, it says a crisis is a time of intense difficulty, trouble, or danger. A time when a difficult and important decision must be made, a crisis. A condition of instability or danger or in social, economic, political, or international affairs leading to a decisive decision. One word for a crisis is, for most of us, it's an emergency. The problem, or as I think about a crisis or a ministry for you, it may not be an issue or emergency or crisis for me. A couple of Sundays ago, my wife got, I left early. She followed me to church in the car, and she came. She had a hat on. She was upset. She was going crazy and wild. She said, I can't think. I can't see. I can't, my hair. I can't get my hair. I said, a crisis for her was, in her hair, was really not a crisis for me. If your house is on fire, your church is about to close, your kids are in a car accident, you get a pink slip, that 2 a.m. call in the morning may mean sadly nothing in this real world to me or the next person, that we may have some sympathy, but we may can't connect. Half of us in this room may be praying for sunshine on Saturday for a wedding or a graduation that's outdoors. The other half can be praying for rain because their tomatoes or their flowers, you want to make sure they're right. So it's just, how do you define a crisis? Coming from your vantage point, maybe different from mine's. I'm trying, as I try to count my nickels, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my dimes to just get to work. Donald Trump said, it hadn't been easy for me. My father had to give me a small loan of $1 million to help me out. And I'm still singing, it's hard out here for a preacher. It's just how you see, how do you define a crisis for you may not be a crisis for the folks on the other side of the room. And that's why Malcolm X, whose birthday was yesterday, said, when white America gets a cold, black America gets pneumonia. Today, for some communities of faith, a crisis would be the concern over global warming and climate control, why we should all eat organically, making sure we plant enough trees for the environment. Are we eating farm-raised animals? Are we fighting against protecting lions and elephants in the circus? For many white or poor Americans or black Americans, we may be worrying about the next meal. You see, the CEO of UPMC makes over a $500,000 a month, $6.4 million a year with bonuses and other pluses, while a member of my church who works for UPMC may be fighting after 10 years of working there for $15 an hour. So how do we define a crisis from our vantage point, from our perspective? I'm not necessarily talking about reciprocity. I'm trying to get a handle on what your church, what your congregation, what you see as a personal or obligational issue around life, crisis. What drives them or you or faith leaders? I've been told that what drives a congregation, you can tell what drives a congregation by its church budget. Oh, I wish I had some help here. I know it's not Sunday, but I got a Friday feeling. Matthew 6:29 says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart." So if you find heart, find treasure.
What drives you? What perks you? What keeps you up? Is historically, it's. So look at your church budget. If there's what's set aside for ministry of kindness for the poor, what's set aside for social justice issues, what's set aside to feed the poor, clothe the naked, house the homeless, support widows, human trafficking, gun violence prevention. What is set aside in this massive church and all of its members? What's set aside in a budget? Or we want to make sure that our children get to certain privileges and places that, and sometimes we feel good that we can send some dollars across the miles and we're never personally affected at all. But if your church isn't personally affected by these issues, by these crises, or the laundry list of other social ills, what are we as a church then called to do? If we are followers of Christ, if we are to be about his business, what is God called? What keeps us up at night that troubles us, that disturbs us, that we can't rest, that we have a longing our heart goes out for? Jesus said, I did not come for the safe or the secure, but I came for the, y'all help me, I came for the lost and for the troubled, for the hurting, for the marginalized, for the disenfranchised. I came for those. What do congregations respond to? What should most congregations respond to? Why should congregations respond? What drives your congregation? What do you get involved in with? What crisis do you respond to? Is it domestic violence or drugs or mental illness, sexism, gun control, classism, colorism, racism, or any other ism? What ism makes you say a charge to keep, I have a God to glorify, a never dying soul to save and fit it for the sky, to serve this present age, my calling to fulfill? What are you called? What crisis calls you to action? Not words, but to action. For I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. Oh, I don't need a whole lot of amens. I'm on my way back to Pittsburgh. It's all good. But I've been asked to speak to this congregation that respond around the issue of gun violence. As of Monday in Chicago, I Googled, it said shot and killed this year, 207. Shot and wounded, 1,095. Total shots, 1,302. Total homicides, 232. I left Chicago, went to another busy city. Baltimore Sun said 25 homicides in the last 30 days. January 14, February 24, March 18, April 28, May 7. There was a time that a community prayed, didn't look forward to it getting warm because they knew there was an increase, but now no longer is it has anything to do with weather. 24 in February. Would you or do you consider, is, should it not be a common denominator that gun violence is a crisis? Can I bring it home to this most livable city called Pittsburgh? Every month, the New Pittsburgh Courier prints the stats. This is May 4th through the 10th. 29 of 36 homicides are black lives. 100% black on black crime.
We can't even go into the black on blue in these issues. A week and a half ago, one of my own members, son was shot, and I had to go and minister to him as, thank God he's living, but again, no one, we don't total the shootings and the effects of the shootings and the cost of emergency rooms and hospitalization and the colostomy bags and 4 and 5 surgeries just if they survive. Those statistics are not recorded, only the homicides. That was Monday, but every day I opened the newspaper. 312 Knoxville teen charged in man shooting. 512 Northside man handed jail term in accidental shooting. 514 Homewood residents arrested in shooting. Penn Hills Oakmont man dies of wounds. 516 two wounded in shooting. And every day I get a blast about another shooting, if not a killing. Crazy stories like in Michigan this week, a young girl finds gun under pillow, kills self. 4-year-old sees a gun in the car and shoots and kills mother. Every day. And then on top of that, Zimmerman can go online and auction off the gun that took the life of Trayvon Martin. And the church says nothing. To my knowledge, self included, God's ambassadors, God's light, God's, and I'm not here to beat us down, but I'm just here to just wonder what does it take for the church to say enough is enough, for the church to say, what should we do, for the church to say, here am I. I see it, church, this gun violence today as a crisis because statistically at least 34 people die daily. 34, somewhere in this world, from gun violence. I see it, conference, as an epidemic. And to define epidemic, it means a widespread occurrence of an infectious disease in a community at a particular time. A disease. It's because many of them who take a life will, they know a camera is right on them, but they're so hopeless, church, that they will shoot you in front of someone and knowing that they're being viewed on tape because they have no hope. Because they say that black boys are becoming, or black men are endangered species. And I say, well, that's not true, because if you understand what an endangered species is, especially if an animal that you want to save, you take special care and attention and provisions to make sure they live. So there's no way, we missed it. There's no way we can be viewed as an endangered species. If the system, if the community, if the church, if Grant Street, if the mayors and public officials and the White House don't say enough is enough. How does the church respond to this gun violence issue? If you're not personally connected, if you're not personally moved, if you're not personally troubled, I stop by to tell you, you're not exempt. That a bullet has no respect of person, race, city, county, hamlet, creed, or denomination. I sit back and wonder how could this happen to a preacher? How can a preacher get a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning saying his son's been shot, and his wife, who's an attorney, how could it happen? It has no respect. How can a preacher who has educated 2 other college-bound graduate students and raise a good boy, not perfect, but a good boy who came home for the first time from Hampton University to attend a party just like your child, a grandchild, and after party, went to a small house for after party, and a frustrated kid is mad at someone on the inside and shoots into a packed house, ending the life of a promising 18-year-old. All of his gifts, all of his talents, all of his potential went to the grave. There's nothing worse than buried potential. Miles Monroe said that potential is unexposed ability, reserve power, untapped strength, cap capacity, unused success, dormant gifts, hidden talents, latent power. What you can do but haven't done yet. Where you can go that you haven't gone yet. Who you can be that hasn't been seen. What you can imagine that hasn't been imagined. How far you can reach that hasn't yet reached. What you can see that hasn't yet been seen, or what you can accomplish that you haven't yet accomplished. Thus, potential, church, is the sum of who you are that you have yet to reveal. It is a deposit that waits to be released and maximized. You are capable of much more than you are presently thinking, imagining, doing, or being. That is your potential. And every day, somewhere, 34 people, potential, is buried because of gun violence. And so I'm pleased that a pastoral care convention is conscious to address this as an issue, concerned for those to some degree who've lost loved ones. You've heard some of the problems, so it doesn't help us to leave without coming up with some solutions. If nothing else, I pray the church can be support for families who've lost loved ones, whether from black on black, black on blue, mass murders, mentally ill, accidents, or suicide. I pray that we who call ourselves God's light bearers can be support. And I know that there are no words. Some people say, I don't know what to do, what to say. They sometimes just hug. Sometimes tears fall from people's eyes. But just the ministry of presence is a ministry. The church can do that. I respect folks' Second Right Amendments, but I've never met a self-respected deer hunter that needed an RK-15 to down a deer. Why someone would need 25 rifles and guns in their home. I pray that the church would be a counseling and support vehicle for families affected by gun violence, and to extend that to whoever is indirectly affected, because people don't realize how many lives are affected directly or indirectly, whether it's a cousin or a neighbor or a friend of a kid who lost his life. We have to ask ourselves the question as citizens, should we really return a gun to someone who left a gun in a car to go into or steal a game, and that gun is stolen and used to take a life. And then the police returns that gun back to that, I say, irresponsible owner. Should we not support for stronger gun laws and restrictions? Should we not push that there is a safety latch on guns, that a four-year-old cannot pick up a gun and take the life of his parent or his sibling? If we can put a safety on a jar, a bottle of water, why can't we put a safety latch on a gun? So, Rebbe, it is a crisis for you. It should move us to make a difference. I just stopped by to just share my story a little bit, because gun violence is, you could be in the supermarket, in a movie theater, at home, and it could happen to you. It could have defined us and gotten the best of us, and it has. I will tell you, for transparency, there are days and moments that I can't move. Father's Day is coming up, and I will never receive a card from my son. I will never go to his college graduation. I will never dance at his wedding. People don't know the emotional toll to sometimes just go to a graduation and hear the pomp and circumstance of the music and tears fall from your eyes, because you could only imagine. God is still merciful. I kind of feel like Job sometimes. Though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Though I don't understand the why, God has a way of still holding you and keeping you. Though we don't understand, you know, life and how could this happen, the human side wrestles with that. We as a family still trust him. We've watched God help us take a bad situation and bring sunshine to others. By the grace and mercy of a community who I think was overall all affected by that October 17th date, black, white, rich, poor, young, old, different denominations, and it was, the outpour was phenomenal. But in ministry, I will tell you that after the chicken dinner and the support and the love for that season, I believe God is calling for the church to never stop. I'm grateful there's one church that will still send 5.5 years later just a card every now and then saying, I'm thinking of you. That is a ministry that can be birthed by almost any small segment of a church. But by the grace of God, I ask God for some things. I ask God for a building that would lease expose our most vulnerable children to more opportunities, because I believe that if that young man who took my son's life had maybe been exposed to a support system, he did not get it home, but had come to a community center that exposed him to culture and other choices that would help develop that critical thinking in his mind. And so God did give us a building that we was able to name the Jerron Xavier Grayson Community Center. And a year and a half later, it is, his presence is very much in the building. Lives are being lifted and lives are being transformed. We continue to take kids out of their 412 zip code to first make them appreciate their zip code and then understand other zip codes. And we're taking 12 kids to Ghana next month to do a service line project. But the community rally, the faith-based community, well, I would say the foundation community, and we raised over $2.2 million to renovate a community center. not only is it a wonderful after-school environment for our kids, but it's become a community asset where it's rented between 4 and 6 times a week, bringing revenue and employment and support for families. God is in control. Yes, He is. God is in control. And we will continue to serve Him and continue to trust Him. But I do believe God is calling for not just the Graysons, and there are so many others doing great things, but God is calling for us to serve this present age. I'll close with one of my favorite persons, Benjamin Mays, who once wrote, "I've only got a minute. Only 60 seconds in it, forced upon me, can't refuse it, didn't seek it, didn't choose it. But it's up to me to use it. I must suffer if I lose it, give account if I abuse it. Just a tiny little minute, but eternity is in it." Again, I thank you for this time and for this opportunity to share a part of my story. And I pray that we will leave here as we take in these various workshops, that something will prick our hearts to say in different areas of our walk of life, what can I, what must I do to make a difference? Because when I stand, and that's what I believe, before God, I want to hear Him say, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. You fed the hungry, you clothed the naked, you visited the sick, you helped the widows, and I put on you a ministry to help young people, to open your doors to those who didn't have your last name." I was at UPrep this morning to take a father to school. Was honored to be there. This young man behind you doesn't have my last name, but I pray that I have been able to be a role model, a father figure, and an inspiration to him. I will not tell you the countless of young people that have come through our home without any benefit other than us loving them, that we raise by the dozens. I pray when it's all said and done, He'll say, "Well done." Thank you. Not sure what if my task was on task, but I believe there are any questions that I can answer or just share from my presentation. I guess the floor is open for at that time if there are any questions. Yes. Good question. The question is basically, as I understand it, do you see some level of diversity transpiring in the Pittsburgh community, especially around the police force? I will say I worked with Penn for many years trying to be an advocate to break through some of those barriers. At the end of the day, there was a lot of just minutiae, red tape that just allowed some things not to happen. Not that he's not here, but I believe that under Chief McClay's administration, we are seeing a shift of some increase in minorities of women, African Americans, and other minorities who are now finally going through and graduating from the academy. The reason why there was a season of a large number, because there was a Sanders decree where we were actually sued for lack of inclusion. But all of those people who were hired during that Sanders decree are, if not retired, or at retirement age. And then we saw probably 10 years of a total white police class and graduates who hit the streets. Many with good hearts, but to some degree, systemic racism has caused us not to understand the African American male, especially. So there's no. The other day, there was a kid I was told who had a BB gun near our building, and which is not illegal. But a BB gun in an African and a 12-year-old African American's hand, with the historic experience of the police force, means his death. Like Tramir Bryce. They don't. They will shoot first and ask later if it's real, versus if it was in Swickley, and kids were playing in the yard. Caucasian kids were playing in the yard with a BB gun. It's our reality. Back to answer the question, so I do believe that we will see a slight increase, but part of it is that there is no trust of this relationship over the years. There are no longer role models where of a comfortability you feel good about being one. So we are trying through CARES to partner and work with, strengthening relationships. We're going to have this summer a basketball tournament with police officers and our young kids at the G Center at the Granville Park. And not only blend in talking about relationships, but talk about, they all want, to have nice cars and want nice homes. And talk about an officer who with very little overtime can make six, if you look at, some of them making $143,000 a year, $99,000 a year. So to tell a kid, do you want to make $100,000? Yeah. Become a police officer. No. We have to break that cycle and let them appreciate, not only is it a wonderful salary, but it's nothing like being diversified because we understand each other better. Nothing moves me more than to see a SWAT car, a cop car go by, and there is, in the front, two cops, one black, one white. It just, or a truck go by, and a blend of just that blend. It just something just easy. And sometimes a kid, and it's a misnomer that necessarily there's someone who looks like you is going to look out for you. That's a misnomer. But historically, it sometimes does ease tension when you see someone who looks like you. For transparency. It could be flipped and go the other way, but historically, because sometimes it's sometime in riding in that police car that you learn how much alike we are versus different, and that you may learn that certain ethnic groups are more hand-gestured and not that they're angry. Historically, African-Americans and Italians are just like, if you close your eyes, in my experience, if you close your eyes at an African-American table and an Italian table with 10 kids, you can't tell the difference of the two rooms. It's building those relationships. I'm one of nine, We're gestures. At my dinner table, we have money in that family. There's four or five conversations going on at the same time. And people, it's not being rude. It's just that we can do it. It's just like, my wife said, one at a time. I said, I heard him. Just culture. Okay, any other questions? Yes. So I guess, good question. When my son's trial came up, in my mind, though it was in Washington County, when I got out of my car in my Holy Ghost imagination, would have would have, I could imagine in my mind what would have come from my soul if there were, you know, 24 pastors lined up as I walked through that courtroom saying, "Hang in there, brother." Like when a police officer is affected. And that was just a fantasy. The church plate is full. And again, we choose our passion and our treasure. And where we put our dollars. And I think there is, not to let the church off the hook, there's a hopeless, we feel, the church feels hopeless. And how do we really address gun violence? You know, like, Rev, how could I, you know, you're in the hill, you know, I live in, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're not affected the same way. I don't know what to do. And I don't have all the answers because it's so broad that it's a cow that is hard to digest, even a bite at a time. We know that through study that there's something called a pipeline through to prison, that if an African-American boy can't read on grade level by the third grade, they're building a prison. They're building his cell. We know that the suspension rate of African Americans are, and kids with disabilities are the highest. They're 3 out of 4 of them are suspended. And not only the number of suspensions, but the number of days they're out of school. At our local middle high school, kids are 3 days, 5 days, 10 days. And that's probably, and I got some statistics on yesterday that it's alarming. Some kids are out of school 1,000 hours a year. Almost 2 months of their education, they're home. They're released to the streets where a parent is not there, a single mom is working, and they're suspended at 9 o'clock, and they're released. An idle, you know, the Bible says an idle mind is what? A devil's workshop. And, you know, and we have some kids who are just vulnerable. And I said to one, that, you know, you could be sitting in the car while your buddy went inside a little grocery store, shot the clerk for $2, and ran back in the car, and you get 25 to life. And you wonder what took him so long to get a pack of gum. Because you were home at 11 o'clock. Giving helps. But hands on deck and a kid can decipher real quickly if it's genuine, you know. And no offense, at some time we can't be the community doesn't need the great white hope, but we need to get a handle on especially on the educational system. We don't need the best teachers to stay in Sewickley and teach. We need the best teachers to come to poor, impoverished communities with those gifts and talents and teach. So we got it twisted. We don't need someone who has tenure to take all those gifts away and let someone who just got out of school loose on kids who come to school with a laundry list of issues that you're not prepared physically, mentally, or inexperienced. And so it's the easy thing for you to do, or the system to do, is to suspend. I mean, a school should have basically a zero tolerance or close to it. And I know that a teacher needs to have, you know, some leverage of what do I do, but we got to find a better way. Because 2 weeks ago, I went to Chicago for training, and at Urban Prep, 100% of the kids, African-American boys, inner-city kids, have been offered opportunities to college, accepted into colleges and major colleges around the country. Same kids. Zero tolerance for suspension. The climate. the climate is different. When a kid walks into school and they have to take their coats off, their bags off, wand down, search, middle of the day search, the climate says you're in prison. And you can't be trusted, and you got issues. But when I went to visit a school down the street, a new school, Holy Family Academy, there's a school now. They started with 10th and 11th, 9th and 10th graders. The atmosphere, the culture is to learn. My granddaughter goes to Colfax, and when I go into that school in Squirrel Hill, I could smell education. They're learning. I could smell it. You should see the number of suspensions of pre-K through fifth grade. So there's a group trying to do a moratorium that you can't suspend a kindergarten kid. But I have a preacher friend whose son is suspended a lot, and he's very strong, a PhD doctor. I don't get it. But it starts, not only are they suspended, but why are they before a magistrate? And then they don't have it together, and they miss their appointments, and then they're ordered to Schumann, and then they are ordered to jail, and then they never, and it's on their record, and then they, it's a cycle that is systemic and intentional. Mm-hmm. And not that long ago, a judge in Pennsylvania sold kids into the prison system. That was real. I tell our kids, I told them this morning, and I'm transparent, 1860, the KKK put on a white robe and a white hood and rode through town and burnt crosses in front of homes and churches and hung black men at the middle of the night. And today, our kids, I said, don't go before a judge who sits behind a bench with a tie and a black robe and gives you 25 to life for stealing a chicken from Giant Eagle. I wish I had some help here. It's real. Yeah. And in their hopelessness, they really roll with the consequence. When I was a kid, my mom said, if you put your hand in a cookie jar, take that cookie, you're going to get a spanking. I said, oh, it's not worth it. This generation will say, okay, I know I'm going to get a spanking. I know I may get 10 years for taking that cookie. I don't get it. And they'll take the cookie. They know the consequence. It's so different. They know it. To their level of understanding, they do get it, but they still rather make that poor decision because of lack of a number of things. Yeah. It's an exclusive club that I wouldn't wish on my enemy if I had one. He had such promise. I mean, not because he was handsome. He was the most valuable player for the football team. He lettered in football, basketball, and track, swimming. I still hear stories about how compassionate he was, and what a leader he was, and a teacher who got on the bus with some other kids they were picking on the kid because he was different, and the teacher felt helpless and kind of said, Jerron, help, and Jerron, on that bus, said, leave him alone, and squashed it. The teachers, people stop me and saying that's how he impacted the impact he had. And back to every day there's a shooting, and we can't even, at least a shooting, not necessarily a killing, but as a parent who loses a child from gun violence, you relive it. every day. And so about a month ago, my wife and I said, well, let's just get out, go to the movies. And we went to see, what movie was it? Oh, Barbershop. It was so painful. We went for, because they're the funny characters. Everyone said how funny it was. And it was really about the moral was about a killing. And so we go for a day out, and it turns to a painful night, because what we thought was going to be a funny movie was, it hit home. And that's daily. And so, for a year and a half, I couldn't go to a cemetery. And I was, I would finish a eulogy, and I would have to ask someone to go for me. I just couldn't. I mean, some people find comfort in visiting a loved one. It's very painful. Our best friends who we see on Sunday live in Staten Heights, and he's at Allegheny, or his body is at the, and Center Avenue, Baum Boulevard was closed. And so I went the other way past the cemetery. And I wish we didn't leave the house. We passed because we go around, that we don't have to go to the cemetery. I can't explain it. We don't have to go there. We don't go that way, because I have to look and see the mausoleum. So we don't go that way. So we always come the other way down Stanton Heights, come around into my friend's house on Rosedale, Rosecrest, because 5.5 years later. And even in your highs, you hit there are programs and things with his name, and you the golf out, and we give scholarships, you come high, and then you think about him not being there, and you go like this. How a parent does it two or three times, I couldn't imagine. I've been pastoral to, buried two children from the same household over different years, and a son, a daughter. It's just, and then God just places you some places sometime. I just happened to be at the church at 7:15 when I heard the gunfire, and went up the steps and watched a young man, take his last breath, Eric Young, who looked just like Jerron, just in terms of just gifts and looks. And so I was in front of his mother's porch, who she had to leave. She couldn't live there, because every time she opened that door, that's all she could see. And this generation will be after you, shoot everyone in this room, miss you, and take away five other people. They don't have, even though they have no dignity and they don't forget. I mean, you could have done something, and they call something called this definition of disrespect. I can't even comprehend what they mean. You disrespected me. I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, well, you looked at my, that was my old girlfriend, and you shouldn't have gone. You shouldn't have gone with her. I said, well, you didn't want her. So, I mean, it's just, you can't even comprehend why some of them come back and take an action. They call it, And I will say it is challenging, because I will say what turns it around, how we can help, is developing relationships. And I've developed relationships where I can see a kid walking down, 17 years as my nonprofit center that cares, if a kid is walking away from school, I can stop, pull over, ask them why you're not in school. They will, and they're very honest, would tell me, or I will put them back in the car and take them to school and say, pull up your pants, out of relationship. But do not confront this generation without relationship, because you will irritate them, and then I can't tell you what may come out or what they may do. I will tell you that. Right, and that didn't happen overnight. But back to what God is calling us to do. In one side, sometime, turn your misery into your ministry. That whatever, whatever misery that God may have allowed to happen, They said, who sinned, this man or his father, that he was born blind? And God said, neither one sinned, but he was born blind, that God make it the glory. And I tell people, so you might have had four kids out of wedlock, and you've been going through. I said, turn your misery that into a ministry that you might help that young lady make a better decision, or take her hand and support her in that. And if you don't really have, by the grace of God, a misery to turn to ministry, ask God, what role can I play? And where would you station me? We all need a crisis, I believe, to attach to in order to be more Christ-like. Oh, Ima Shana. Can I say that? I said, we all need, as Christians, a crisis to attach to that we might be more Christ-like.
Amen.
But I just don't think, as we believe, that we will stand before him and can't think of, and can't say, well, you know, I've been blessed. You know, I had two parents. I went to finish high school. I went to college. My two kids, you know, got married. I had four grandkids. I had a nice home. You know, I went to church. I paid my tithes. I sent money to, you know, orphanages. I helped Africa. But I think he's calling. I know he's calling us to get some, you know, we got to get dirty. We got to get real. And I believe if we bring our heart to any situation and it's our heart, God will bless and God will cause an increase. And God will reassure that person that you were sent to be comfort and strength. We'd rather be the head, not the tail, anyhow, if we had a choice. I'd rather blessed than have to ask. Oh, I wish I had some help. I'd rather have someone say, brother, do you have $10? And for me to say, do you have $10? Well, come on, somebody. If I had a choice in this thing. Huh? And so I'm glad that when someone says, can I have $10, that I can give $10 because, you know, there by the grace of God, there go I. Maybe sharing comes naturally for me because I had no option with 9-11 people in one little household. It was not, you know, one bathroom, you know, huh? Every bedroom, every room was a bedroom. I mean, and so when people say, how many kids, and how many people do you have in your house, Reverend Grayson? I say, I can't tell. It's people. I mean, and I it was good because my kids were blessed with some privileges that I didn't want them to be so, you know, beside themselves. So they had, it's good you share it. You're sharing. They're jealous of Raekwon because they think he gets more than they got. They are. And he probably does. I'm at a better place. And I'm at a better place. I got two more. I had two quarters, and I had one quarter. You know what I'm saying? You know. But I always try to. So it was no surprise that God laid on my heart, Center That Cares For, when I got to the church, put the key in the door, that I looked in with four or five boys, you know, saying, you know, holding on to me. So gave birth to Children/Adult Recreational Educational Services. Had no compass, just said, this is God, this is where he lead me. And 17 years later, we have a million-plus budget. We're affecting 150 lives during the summer, another 150 during the school year. It's all free. We take them to New York and D.C. and North Carolina college tour. I mean, it's only God. And I feel unworthy of awards and recognition because it's God. There's nothing, I mean, just like, it's not me. It's really God. And it keeps, why? I've done nothing but what we're called to do as God's children.
That's
What I'm looking for that reward, but it's not here. And so it's hard for me. I'm not a receiver, which is my issue. But I want him to say, well done. And I pray he would cover my family. My human biggest fear that I would never experience this again, that I would, that my children would bury me and I would never bury them. That's my prayer to God. It is too painful. It's too painful. Imagine, you know, you really would think he would be 23. What would he look like? And where would he be? It's just sometime, you know. Your memories end. Death cannot rob us of precious memories. I'm grateful, but that memory can't exceed someone's lifetime. So my memory doesn't go past 18 and a half years because I can't. I thoughts can, but not a memory. He was a knucklehead. He was wonderful. I mean, have wonderful, you know, he could, you know, take his chest and do, I don't know what he could do. But can't rob me of that, but I'm robbed of his potential. But then God, you know, so many lives are I don't want to believe that he was a sacrificial lamb for so many greater things, but maybe that's, I still spiritually wrestle with so, you know, so much stuff, but when I see what the impact of what Cares is doing now, maybe, because I don't know if you know the story, but Jerron asked to come home from Hampton for the first time. I said yes, and most parents worry about a kid getting in a car accident. En route home, he got into a car accident that almost took his life. His car rolled under an 18-wheeler. And so I can't remember who was driving. So 2 o'clock in the morning, I had that car towed, and he came home and said, "Daddy, I have a testimony." Not that I didn't think he was saved, but he said, "I got my very own testimony. And I'm going to take Cares global." I said, "Well, wait a minute. It ain't global enough under me?" And he got up that morning after we laughed and talked that Saturday and shared his testimony everywhere we went. He hung out with me. We went to the old house. We were laughing. He tried on some things from the past. He ran into a couple people. And 30 hours later, he was gone, not from the accident, which still could have been a story, but he was going through from gun violence. And I didn't jump on the gun violence wagon after his death. I was an advocate, for whatever reason, against gun violence pre his death. But God, I believe, had a hand in why he was going to use gun violence as to propel, and that he was going to use that situation to allow that building to come to being, a permanent 14,000 square foot location with his name, and how his name would last and how he would take Cares, like he said, global. And so it hurts, but I know he's up to something. All the time. And he said that he would get the glory. And I just believe, for even my place here, it's no accident that it's just me and not the chief, and that you're here and not other folks. Because I still believe that God is up to something and that God will get the glory. I don't believe that no one has come through my life by accident, but God will get the glory. I don't believe that Raekwon, who God put in my life, is by accident, that God will get the glory. Because it soothed my heart just to take care of another child to that level. I trust him. Pray for me as I pray for you, but ask God, as I'm not sure the time frame is that it's over.
Yes, yes. What we, where would he have, how can you be, how can you best be a vessel for him, where and how? And where he placed you, ask God to lead and guide you and to give you the heart and the compassion to be there, and if not, move you out the way if you're not the right person for that work or that ministry. Thank you. I'm good. I thank you for your time and consideration. Amen. Thank you.